From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, French screenwriter Jean-Claude Carrière. He's collaborated with such internationally acclaimed directors as Louis Buñuel, Jean-Luc Godard, and Louis Malle. Carrière's films include Belle du Jour, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, The Return of Martin Guerre, and The Unbearable Lightness of Being. This month, he was given the Writers Guild of America's highest honor. We'll talk about his 19-year collaboration with Buñuel and the effect of psychoanalysis and surrealism on his filmmaking. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by crossover country singer Shelby Lynn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House reacted angrily today to an attack on the president by a senior official of the National Rifle Association. The NRA's executive vice president, Wayne LaPierre, accused the president of exploiting gun deaths to advance his own political agenda. LaPierre said he believes the administration has not enforced existing gun laws so that the president can cite various murders as examples of the need for greater gun control. The president said today that the NRA was guilty of smearing him, and he called it a horrible political mistake. The diplomatic stalemate over who should be the International Monetary Fund's next managing director has finally been broken, NPR's Kathleen Schalk reports.
The Clinton administration says it will support the European Union's new choice to head the IMF. Earlier today, members of the EU lined up behind Horst Köhler, who currently leads the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. Germany nominated Köhler after the first candidate it picked, Keo Kokweser, was rejected by the U.S. European support for Kokweser was only lukewarm. In contrast, all 15 members of the EU rallied quickly around Köhler and pledged to lobby for him. He's widely respected in Europe for his role in launching Europe's single currency, the euro, and channeling aid to the former Soviet bloc. By signing off on Europe's choice, the U.S. is upholding a long-standing tradition. Europeans have always headed the IMF, while the U.S. has picked leaders for its sister institution, the World Bank. Kathleen Schalk, NPR News, Washington.
A top Bosnian Serb general has gone on trial at the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal at The Hague. Radoslav Krstic is charged with genocide for commanding the execution of thousands of Muslims after the fall of the UN safe area in Srebrenica in 1995. Lauren Kamato reports from The Hague.
7,574. That's how many Muslim men and boys prosecutors estimate are missing, presumed dead, as a result of a genocidal campaign by the Bosnian Serb army. Prosecutors say General Radoslav Krstic commanded the troops, and much of their evidence will focus on proving that. Jean-René Ruiz was the first witness to take the stand. As the war crimes investigator responsible for the Srebrenica investigations, he talked judges through video footage taken by a Serb journalist. Much of it eerily captured the scene leading up to the massacres.
All these men have been identified by face, and they are all missing.
Judges also got to see pictures of General Krstic entering Srebrenica with General Ratko Mladic, the commander of the Bosnian Serb army. Mladic has also been charged with genocide for the crimes of Srebrenica, but remains free. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Kamato in The Hague.
The Dow gained 18 points today to close at 9,947. The Nasdaq lost 141, or 2.8%, to close at 4,907. This is NPR. Officials from the Justice Department are meeting today with the chief of the Los Angeles Police Department. The federal government is looking into possible civil rights violations in the LAPD's corruption-plagued Rampart Division. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
The head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, Bill Lon Lee, and a top aide will spend the next 2 days in Los Angeles meeting with the Civilian Police Commission and the city attorney, as well as L.A. Police Chief Bernard Parks. They've been closely following the investigations into the allegations that Rampart Division anti-gang officers routinely beat and framed innocent people. Now the federal civil rights officials want to see if there's a pattern and practice of misconduct in the LAPD. They also want to know why many recommendations in the Watershed Christopher Commission report of 1991 have yet to be implemented. One example, the Christopher Commission recommended that the department set up a system to track so-called problem officers. Yet a grant from the federal government that would have paid for such a system still sits in the bank, untouched by the LAPD. Ina Jaffe, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The Immigration and Naturalization Service has deported a 78-year-old Detroit man suspected of being a guard at two Nazi concentration camps during the Second World War. Ferdinand Hammer is a retired foundry worker who's lived in the United States for 45 years. U.S. officials picked him up at his home near Detroit today and put him on a plane to Vienna, Austria, to stand trial. Hammer's lawyer said his client was recently diagnosed with dementia, most likely from Alzheimer's disease. His grandson traveled with him to Austria to help him get settled. Hammer became an American citizen in 1963, but was stripped of his citizenship. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This month, French screenwriter Jean-Claude Carrière became the first foreign language writer ever to be given the Screen Laurel Award from the Writers Guild of America. The award is for the advancement of the literature of motion pictures. Carrière has collaborated with such internationally renowned directors as Louis Buñuel, Jean-Luc Godard, Louis Malle, Volker Schlondorf, and Peter Brook. Carrière has written or co-written such screenplays as The Tin Drum, The Return of Martin Guerre, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, Valmont, and The Mahabharata. He's best known for his 19-year collaboration with Spanish film director Luis Buñuel, with whom he co-wrote Diary of a Chambermaid, Belle de Jour, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, and That Obscure Object of Desire. Carrière even co-wrote Buñuel's autobiography. I spoke with Jean-Claude Carrière about his movies and asked him first about his Buñuel collaboration Belle de Jour, which they adapted from a novel. This 1967 film stars Catherine Deneuve as a beautiful woman who is sexually unresponsive with her husband and retreats to the world of her sadomasochistic fantasies. Compelled by her desire to live out these fantasies, she secretly becomes a prostitute at a high-class brothel. I asked Carrière about his interest in this character's sadomasochistic fantasies.
At the very beginning, we never thought about a masochistic tendency, you know, about Séverine, that was the name of the woman. We were interested in the basic story written by Kessel, and we saw the possibility to insert some daydreams, images, you know, and some reveries and phantasma for a woman. But a little by little, step by step, when we start talking to women, to hookers, to prostitutes, to madams, to psychoanalysts, to psychiatrists, you know, we realized that she was basically a masochist. And that's why finally, you know, the film is very often presented as the portrait of a masochistic woman, which at the beginning was not the intention. The intention was not to make a film about, not even to make a film about sex, but to make a film about reality on one side and what I could call an imaginary world on the other side, and to try to present the two worlds, the real one and the unreal one, on the same level of cinematographical reality, not to change the image when we pass from one word to the other one. We wanted to try to show that in our personalities, you know, what we do and what we dream of are the same and are the two basic elements of our personality. There is no real difference between the two of them, and very often the imaginary world we live in, it's more real than the so-called reality.
How did you come up with the masochistic fantasies that you gave this woman in Belle de Jour?
By the examples that, you know, everything in the film, which is a phantasma, is real, has been really lived up by somebody. Many people told us about, you know, and finally, after a few weeks or months, I don't remember, of investigation, inquiries, you know, here and there in Paris, in Madrid, we came up to the idea of eliminate everything which was not masochistic in order to present a coherent character. You know, not to do anything about a woman, but just to maintain her in our own way.
And did you and Buñuel keep trying out these different fantasies, ones that you had heard about through other women?
No, it was very difficult for two men, for the first time in I think in the history of the cinema, to enter what Freud called the black continent, which is the woman's sexuality. It was extremely difficult for us, especially for one of the two men being Spanish, you know, where the sexual love was extremely contrived at the time by the Catholic Church. So we took all the possible precautions, you know, to enter this unknown and threatening territory.
What are the precautions?
not to write and direct the film from a male point of view. You understand what I mean? Not trying to put inside a woman's mind what a man would dream to find there. You know, to be really precise, exact, to be honest. In other words, to our man character.
So how would you know? The difference was what
because
you talk to a lot of women.
Yes, we talk to a lot of women, and everything which is in the film as a fantasy is real.
Mm-hmm. Real everything. In the sense that it was a woman's fantasy, or that
yes,
a woman
absolutely.
Lived it.
There were real fantasies of women that they have told to us, sometimes with a certain, sometimes it was rather difficult for them to admit, you know. But everything, even you know, when she receives mud, for instance, on her face, that had, this daydream, I mean, let's say, has been told to us by at least five or six women, never by a man.
This film was made in 1964 at...
No, 65.
65, okay. Right. And standards for what could be shown on screen were much tighter than they are now.
Yeah.
Was your film censored at all? Was Belle de Jour censored?
I was censored. I was, you know, having the part in the film. Buñuel, as usual, gave me the part of a priest. And I was celebrating a mass at one moment in the film, the scene of the coffin. And that was the only thing in the film which was censored. Nothing about sex. Anyway, in the film, you don't see anything. You don't see a naked breast. Not even that, you know. Everything is suggested. Everything is undercovered, you know, by something else. So the film couldn't be formally. There was nothing that could have been censored in the film, except maybe the words. But even the words are not, you know, are not four letters words at all. So the only thing they could, they tried, but the only thing they could take off was the religious, you know, aspect of it. It was a very short moment anyway. It was not quite important.
So what was it about that moment that you were in that got censored?
You know, if you remember, there is a scene when the Severine, I mean the lady who goes to the brothel, is taken into a castle by a man who asks her to put herself in a coffin as if she were her dead daughter. And then he speaks to her in a very strange way, goes down under the coffin, and probably, we don't see it, probably masturbates himself. That was one very precise fantasy that had been told to us by a man's fantasy. So before that scene, which is still in the film, there was a priest in the same room celebrating the mass, and it was too much, you know, that the man was serving the mass to the priest. The priest was leaving the room. He wasn't there during the rest of the scene. But the fact that it was a sort of link of a secret connection between the mass and the fantasy was not allowed, you know, and was censored.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jean-Claude Carrière, and he just received the Screen Laurel Award from the Writers Guild of America for advancing the literature of the motion picture. When Buñuel told you that he wanted you to write Bel du Jour with him, he described the novel that it was based on, or at least the version of it he wanted to make, as a story about a woman's conflicts between her superego and her id. Now, in his autobiography, which you wrote, he said, "I didn't like psychology in general, or analysis, or psychoanalysis. On the other hand, my discovery of Freud, and particularly his theory of the unconscious, was crucial to me." Can you talk about that a little bit, and how you think that applied to the work you did together?
First of all, when he decided to make Bel du Jour as a film, we had already worked together. We knew each other. We had written Diary of a Chambermaid and another film called The Monk, which he never released, he never directed. So we knew. And I was at that time working with Louis Malle when I received a letter from Buñuel about Bel du Jour. Bel du Jour had been offered to several other directors, French directors, who had all refused to make a film because they thought it was cheap, you know, it was banal, that the book wasn't very good, the book by Joseph Kessel. And Louis Malle was surprised that Buñuel had accepted. And I showed Louis the letter where Buñuel was talking about, in a very ironic way, about conflicts between the superego and the id. Because, you know, he knew about, he was extremely interested about Freud and the discovery of the unconscious and all of that, but did not really believe in it. It didn't really believe in the therapy of it. So talking about the conflicts between the superego and the id was, I knew him well, and I saw immediately the irony of what he was saying. Nevertheless, when we came to the point of writing the film, as I said to you, we try to be as honest as possible to the, I wouldn't say the psychology of the woman, of the main character. I would say the behavior, you know, which is something totally different. A movie maker, a film director, observes the characters he's dealing with. You know, he's like, and Buñuel had a formation when he was a student of an entomologist, and he was observing the behavior of the insects. And it's about the same way when he goes to the human characters. He does exactly what he sees, what he observes. It is real, physically real. I mean, what happens really happens. But he doesn't really care about the invisible pillars of human behavior, which, as he said many times to him, looked arbitrary and anyway changing all the time.
My guest is French screenwriter Jean-Claude Carrière. This month he won the Writers Guild of America's Laurel Award for screenwriting. Carrière had a long collaboration with the Spanish film director Luis Buñuel. We'll talk after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is French screenwriter Jean-Claude Carrière. How did you first meet Buñuel and start to work with him?
We met in 1963 at the Cannes Film Festival. He was looking for a French screenwriter to write Diary of a Chambermaid, which is based on a 19th century French novel by Octave Mirbeau. And he wanted the writer to know rather well the French countryside, which, you know, I was born in the countryside and I was French and I was young. I had the three qualities he was asking for. So we met at the Cannes Film Festival and he met with several other French screenwriters, you know, I don't know exactly which ones at the time. When I arrived, I had, of course, read the novel and prepare a survey, I mean, something like a first possibility of an adaptation to make the novel into a film. But our first contact, it looks anecdotal, but it is not. I was waiting for him in the hall office, in the lobby of the hotel, and he came up. It was on the terrace. Went to me, took me to the dining room. We were meeting for the first time, and I was extremely impressed by Buñuel, of course, who was already a monument in the history of the cinema. We sat down at the table, and he looked at me with his very special look. He had eyes, as the great directors have, eyes that see everything, you know, outside and inside you. So he looked at me with these eyes and asked me, do you drink wine? You know, I understood immediately that it was not a superficial question, but a deep one, meaning, do we at least have something in common? You know, if we don't agree about a film, could we talk about wine? And when I answered to him, not only I drink wine, but I come from a family of winemakers, wine producers, his face, you know, got radiant. And he called the waiter and said, please, two bottles. That was, you know, like breaking ice between the two of us. And I was born in the south of France, not very far from the Spanish border. We were not from the same generation, of course. He was 31 years older than I was. But we had something in common, some ground, you know, some tradition, some Latin background, you know, and mostly wine, I must say. So I went back to Paris without knowing anything about his decision. About a week later, the producer told me that he had chosen me. I never knew if it was because of what I had proposed as a possible adaptation, or if it was due to the wine.
Buñuel had been very interested in surrealism, and I guess the best example is the film he collaborated on with Salvador Dali, Un Chien Andalou. And he had said about that film that they only kept the images they couldn't explain. I'm wondering if you feel that surrealistic streak entered into the films that you wrote with him, and if you were ever tempted to demand an explanation, to demand that an image be consistent with the character or with the plot.
You know, apparently it's impossible to make a surrealistic film because you need time to make a film. You need to prepare, to write a script, to shoot the film, to edit the film. And the surrealistic activity goes with a certain improvisation, certain instinct writing, you know, automatic writing, mm-hmm. as they said at mm-hmm. the time. So apparently it's impossible. To try to reach something unusual in the writing of a film, we used what we call the right of veto, that he already used with Salvador Dali when writing, you know, the Lucian Dog.
What is it, the right of what?
The right of veto, V-E-T-O.
Right.
So the right of veto means that you propose me something, an idea for a scene, any scene, a situation. I have 3 seconds, no more than 3 seconds, to tell you yes or no. Why 3 seconds? To prevent my rational side to intervene, to get from me, or I from him, to get the instinctive answer coming from your unconscious side. You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
You propose me an idea, if I say no, you have no right to defend your idea. You must go to another one. You know, that's the way we have been working for 20 years.
It sounds like you made it into a game.
Yes, it's like a game. And don't forget that one of the activities of the surrealistic group was precisely the games. The surrealistic games were very famous, and there were an attempt to train and develop the imagination. The human imagination considered as a muscle, like memory, for instance. All the actors know that memory can be developed, can be trained. It's about the same with imagination. Imagination knows no limit. You know, you can go and go all day long if you are trained and if you are in good shape and if you are willing to do so, you know. avoiding comprehension, avoiding too much intelligence, trying to go as far as possible inside each of us. That's really, there is the link between Buñuel's, you know, earlier formation, and, you know, he really belonged for a long time to the group of the surrealistic poets, and our work. After that, of course, that was one of the contradictions of Buñuel's work that François Truffaut once noted, that everything he does as a work is instinctive. It's, you know, sudden, is improvised, and at the end, he ends up with a very well-built-up script.
Let's get back to this game of vetoing each other's images. Who used the veto power more, you or Dahl?
At the beginning, I didn't dare. At the beginning, you know, you are a young screenwriter. You right. find yourself facing Buñuel, and Buñuel proposes, you know, offers an idea to you, and you say, "Hop, I don't know. I don't like it. It's quite impossible." At the beginning, I want to love what he was proposing, you know. So after 2 weeks, on the very first film we wrote together, the producer, Serge Silverman, came down from Paris to Madrid where we were working, and he had a dinner with me. And at the end of the dinner, he said, you know, Buñuel is very happy, likes you very much. He says that you work well and so, but you have to say no to him from time to time. You know, and I understood that Buñuel had asked the producer to come just to tell me this phrase. So the following day, I tried to, from time to time, to oppose, not to agree, to even from time to time to fight, to come to a quarrel with Buñuel. And that's exactly what he needed. He needed, what he needed was not a Mr. Yes, you know, approving everything, but somebody would not only would propose and offer ideas, but would oppose his and reject. And after that, I mean, if I don't remember exactly, but a few weeks later, we came to the right of veto, the famous veto right.
French screenwriter Jean-Claude Carrière. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Turner Classic Movies, presenting 31 Days of Oscar. Tomorrow night, The Black Stallion. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House and its Bantam Books division, publisher of Bones of the Master, A Buddhist Monk's Search for the Lost Heart of China by George Crane. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In the dark, I can hear you whisper.
Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by Shelby Lynn. We're listening to it now. And we continue our talk with French screenwriter Jean-Claude Carrière.
The distance. Did you miss me?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with French screenwriter Jean-Claude Carrier. This month, he was given the Writers Guild of America's Laurel Award for screenwriting. He's the first foreign language writer to be given that honor. Carrier has collaborated with such directors as Jean-Luc Godard, Louis Malle, Volker Schlondorf, and Peter Brook. During his 19-year collaboration with Spanish director Luis Buñuel, Carrier co-wrote Diary of a Chambermaid, Belle du Jour, and The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie. Did Buñuel's interest in surrealism manifest itself in daily life as well as in art? Did he ever behave in a certain way that reflected his interest in surrealism, and was it ever hard for you to figure out how to respond to that?
It was not, I wouldn't say it was not a terrorist nor a revolutionary. We know he had a very peaceful family life with his wife and sons. But he had in his private life something which was absolutely surrealistic. It was the love of the practical jokes, you know, of changing the word with jokes, you know, making people believe this and that. And he was very famous for loving to laugh and trying to... It's a sort of slight perversion of the reality. I give you an example, for instance, an American example. Once we were in Spain working on a film, and The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie was nominated for the Academy Award in Los Angeles. So four Mexican journalists came to see us, and one of them asked Buñuel, "Do you think that you'll get the Academy Award?" And Buñuel said, "But of course I get it. I already paid $25,000. I'm supposed to pay another $25,000 when I get the award." And, you know, the Americans, they have some wrong sides sometimes, but they are men of word. They keep their word, you know. 3 days later, that was published in the Mexican newspaper. Buñuel, I have paid $25,000 to get the Academy Award. And it was a certain, in the milieu, a real scandal. You know, the producer came from Paris, he was out of his mind. "What did you say? I mean, it's impossible. I mean, it's going to be a real scandal and we'll never get it." And Buñuel was, you know, kept saying, "But that's a very innocent joke." It was not so innocent. And finally, when we got the Academy Award for the best foreign film, Buñuel was telling the journalist, "You see, I had told you, Americans have some wrong sides, but they keep their word."
So that's it's amazing that they believed him, that they took him literally.
Yeah, absolutely. They did believe it and they did right. He was so serious, you know. He was very good at making practical jokes, extremely good. And even to me, you know, sometimes, for instance, I was entering his room. He was deaf, so I was entering. He was
deaf later in his life.
Yes, yeah. He would leave the door ajar, the door open, so that I could walk in. And twice, when I, you know, walked into his room, he was dead, just dead, you know, lying on the floor, you know, with the eyes reversed and 1 foot on the table, all the papers, you know. It was, and the first time, I was extremely, I really thought he was dead. So that was that sort of very black humor, very Spanish black humor. The second time, of course, I said, "Buñuel, that doesn't work. You did it already once." And so he got up and he said, "Oh, excuse me, I forgot I had already made it."
Well, on the last page of his autobiography, which you wrote, he says that he'd like to, before he dies, surprise all of his friends, because he was an atheist and his friends were atheists, so he wanted to invite over a priest so he could make a confession and then ask for extreme unction and see how his friends reacted. Did he actually do anything like a practical joke when he was very near death?
You know, he never did it because, that's quite sad to remember. I went to see Buñuel and it was about 2 months before he died. He knew he was dying, and he knew that I knew. So we could talk freely about his death. So I said to him, "Are you going to make this joke, Luis?" You know, with tears in my in my eyes. And he said to me, "No, I told the joke too many times, and nobody would believe what I would say." Mm-hmm. So he didn't do it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jean-Claude Carrier, and he has just received the Screen Laurel Award from the Writers Guild of America for advancing the literature of the motion picture. Buñuel said, if someone were to tell me I had 20 years left and ask me how I'd like to spend them, I'd reply, "Give me 2 hours a day of activity, and I'll take the other 22 in dreams, provided I can remember them. I love dreams, even when they're nightmares, which is usually the case." I'm wondering if you started paying more attention to your dreams working with him, and if your dreams ended up figuring into any of your work.
That was absolutely important from the very beginning. I am a dreamer. I have a lot of dreams. You know, I dream a lot for all my life. So the very first time we met at the Cannes Film Festival, he asked me about my dreams. And do you dream? Do you drink wine? Was the first important question. The second was, do you dream? And later, he told me that once André Breton, you know, was the pope of the surrealistic movement, had said about somebody he disliked very much, said, "This man is a son of a bitch. He never dreams." You know, so I couldn't say, "No, I don't dream." But, you know, not only Buñuel comforted me in the exactly the same pleasure, the same ravishing pleasure, I mean, to be a dreamer, but he taught me how to use it in a film. And sometimes, because he said all the time that usually in a film, a dream, it's a logical illustration of the story. And in life, it is never the case. So we have to be very careful when we put a dream in a film. But every morning when we met, every morning of our work, maybe one of the first, tasks of the day was to tell each other our dreams without trying to hide anything. And sometimes, I remember, I can confess it now, sometimes when I couldn't remember my dreams, or maybe I had not dreamed, I would invent some dreams. And once he had a doubt about my sincerity, I remember this, and we almost got into a fit.
He could tell that you invented the dream.
Yeah, yeah.
How could he tell?
He could tell. I don't know if it was the dream itself or probably the way I was telling it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes you can when you must know that we have been working for 19 years together and we knew each other very well. I mean, we have been eating together, just the two of us, more than 2,000 times. Which is, you know, there are many, many couples who can say the same, you know. So any change in my look, in my voice, he would notice. And the same, and it was reciprocal. So I suppose it was something in the way I was not acting well, you know, in other words, you know, not well enough.
My guest is French screenwriter Jean-Claude Carrier. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jean-Claude Carrier, and he has just won an award from the Writers Guild. It's the Screen Laurel Award from the Writers Guild of America. And you have collaborated with such directors as Buñuel, Louis Malle, Jean-Luc Godard, Volker Schlondorf, Peter Brook. These are all very eccentric people. Let's talk about working with Jean-Luc Godard. You wrote Every Man for Himself. For Godard. What's it like writing for Godard? I mean, Godard is so...
Godard, writing with Godard, first of all, is very exciting, you know, because you don't write. You don't write a script the way you do it usually. Godard likes very much to talk with his collaborator. So we get together anywhere in his place in Switzerland, for instance, and we start talking about what could happen. And then after that, alone, he takes a video camera and starts shooting like the very first draft of a film. For instance, for the film you were quoting, he shot some images, even of the actor he wants to work with, of a woman biking in the countryside, the reproduction of a painting by Bonnard, for instance. And then he makes a 15-20 minutes film, which is absolutely like a draft. And then we get together again, and he shows the film to me, stops every moment and asks, is there a scene there? You understand? If I'd better answer yes, if not, there is no film. So, for instance, I remember, I give you an example to make it, because it may sound unclear. We see he has a painting by Bonnard, a naked woman is sitting in an armchair by a window looking outside. A question by Godard, is there a scene there? I answer, yes. So he says, what happens? I say, somebody is ringing the bell at the door. He says, who? A man. What sort of a man? A man with a suitcase. What's in the suitcase? And et cetera. You understand?
Yeah.
We don't start with an idea, but with an image. Already with an image, which is extremely interesting. And it's very exciting for the mind of the writer to work that way, because it's unusual. And we try to do it sometime. For instance, with Phil Kaufman working on the unbearable lightness of being. You know, we were surrounded by images from Czechoslovakia. And from time to time, we would just look at the image as if photographs, for instance, of the streets in Prague, of some Czech characters, you know, some Czech women, and trying to by a sort of... to see through the image if there is a scene, if there is a movement, an emotion, a sentiment, something that could lead us to the writing of a scene.
I could see how that could also be a little frustrating in a way, because you're doing it. It's this like step-by-step process without having an overview of what the film is about from
Absolutely.
The start.
Absolutely, it is frustrating because you are working on a film without having the camera and everything that you need to make a film.
And without having a larger structure yet.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's an image at a time.
It's very vague, very frustrating, disappointing. One day, one week, you like a scene, 2 weeks later, you hate it, and you find it very banal, and you never know. Of course, it's better to be two. If you are alone, you get sometimes desperate about, how to get there, how to get to the film. So it's a very strange situation to be a screenwriter, because you are like working on the, how could I say, on the caterpillar, which is going to be a butterfly. But you are just putting together the elements that constitute the caterpillar, the colors, the cells, everything. But your script doesn't fly, it needs to be transformed into a butterfly, into a film, and to take off. So it is always frustrating, but that you must know, if you are a screenwriter, that you are not a novelist. You are not working on a piece of writing which is bound to last. Just the opposite. It's provisory, It will, at the end of a shooting, you find the script in the garbage can, and that's all right.
What do you think are one or two of the best written movies that you've ever seen?
One of the best written movies is really the French film Children of Paradise.
I love that film.
Yes, written by Jacques Prévert. That's really a man. It's strangely enough, the man was a poet. A poet apparently has no structure. You know, it doesn't know how to build up a story. And if you look carefully at the script of Children of Paradise, which is a classical French film, it's beautifully a build-up. I mean, the construction of the film is unparalleled. It's fantastic. And not only that, but the dialogue of the film, that's the ideal. Every person, every character in the film speaks at his own social level. You know, popular, aristocratic, popular, educated, ignorant, you know. They all have a special language, but they all speak Jacques Prévert, you know. They all say Jacques Prévert's phrases and words. I don't know how it goes, but that's the real mystery of creation, literary creation. And I'm a great admirer of this film. There are many others. I have a special affection for the Italian screenwriter Tonino Guerra, you know, who work a lot with Fellini and Antonioni. He's the one who wrote Amarcord, which is one of my favorite movies by Fellini. Also, I would quote Rashomon, the Japanese film. Mm-hmm. It's a perfect script. You know, it's a sort of crucial point in the history of the cinema, and to me, it's a film that I can see and see again and again.
We in America only get to see a few of the French films released each year. What do you think is the state of the French film industry now?
It's doing rather well. I mean, especially in the past 2 or 3 years, we have made, you know, more than 150 films that here. And as usual, we have out of 100 films, when we have 3 or 4 good films, it's a very good average. And it's a pity that we don't see not only French film, but European films in America. You know, there is an American offensive to conquer the world of the movie distribution all over the world, in every country. We try to resist. It's a pity for us, and it's a pity for the American audience not to see anything from any other country.
Do you think that, I know there's a lot of people in France who like to limit the amount of American popular culture that penetrates France so that it doesn't...
There is no limitation. I mean, I think the American movies, you know, occupied about more than 60% of the French audience.
Does that bother you? Do you think that American culture is kind of wiping out or overshadowing different regional cultures around the world?
No, it doesn't bother me for myself. I mean, because I still have the possibility to see French and Italian films. Mm-hmm. You know, I was in India in January at the Film Festival of Delhi. I saw many interesting films, extremely interesting films from Asia, for instance, that you will never see in America. It's a pity for America.
Right.
Not for us.
Right. Mm. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
French screenwriter Jean-Claude Carrière. This month he was given the Writers Guild of America's Screen Laurel Award. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by Shelby Lynn. This is Fresh Air. Shelby Lynn recorded 5 albums before her new one, which is called I Am Shelby Lynn. They were all country records and were commercial failures, even though Lynn's vocals were unanimously praised. For her new CD, Lynn has collaborated with producer Bill Bottrell, who produced Sheryl Crow's breakthrough album, Tuesday Night Music Club. The result is a more unusual showcase, which rock critic Ken Tucker says is Lynn's best yet.
What is that? It doesn't sound much like country music, or rather, it sounds like a very particular, almost forgotten kind of country music. That song, Your Lies, was written by Shelby Lynn and producer Bill Bottrell in the manner of the 1960s style dubbed Countrypolitan. It was virtually invented by the Nashville guitarist and producer Chet Atkins, who emphasized strings and horns in a way that had been anathema to hardcore country. Countrypolitan was created to cross over to a pop audience, which is exactly what Shelby Lynn wants to do, and her determination gives her music a rigor and energy that most Countrypolitan never attained.
My guess is it's that big. Reality is at home. No need in putting it off anymore. Just turn away and let me walk out the door. You thought you had it all figured out, but baby, you don't know what love's about. It's time for me to spend some time alone. I'm tired of trying to make this your happy home. I'm leaving. Sad. This time is for good. You should have treated me. I'm leaving sad, and you can't make me stay. I'm tired of hurting you. This ain't no good anyway.
Until now, Shelby Lynn's personal story always overshadowed her music. When she was still a teenager in Alabama, her father killed both her mother and himself, and Shelby married and divorced. She attracted attention as a performer for possessing a voice that seemed bigger, more mature than her age. Her vocal instrument was a producer's dream, a power to be harnessed. But no one could figure out how to do that, and as a result, all of Lynn's albums up to now have sounded compromised by her desire to be accepted within Nashville's mannerly musical style. That's why the title of this one, I Am Shelby Lynn, has the ring of a manifesto.
You and your element of dangerous, cheating death like a stranger, but devil's got your shirt tail clutched in the palm of his hand. Double vodka on the rocks on a plastic tray. Never fails you, but it won't take the hours away. Yeah. Why can't you be? It's plain to see you drive yourself crazy.
Shelby Lynn is 31 now, and in working with Bill Bottrell, who has co-written nearly every song with her here, she's making shrewd compromises that only occasionally wobble. As when Lynn permits Bottrell to turn her into a Sheryl Crow sound-alike on Life is Bad. Shelby Lynn is not the CD that's going to put Lynn in competition with Shania Twain and Garth Brooks. It's still too idiosyncratic for country radio and too country for rock radio, but it's certainly not the uneven, compromised work she's settled for in the past. It's a prickly, lovely album, hard-earned, and it'll come as a pure pleasure to any pop music fan with the good fortune to take a chance on someone who's turning a discredited 30-year-old musical style into something fresh and vital.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed I Am Shelby Lynn. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Monique Nazareth and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Brendan Noonan. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Smoking and thinking of things to do since you're gone. Sitting lonely, can't even get stoned. Taking a breath of a feeling that once lived in this house. Laughing and dying at the mirror in the hall. Myself, a memory don't remember at all. Last thing you told me was the first thing that brought on these clouds. I'm looking up for the next thing that brings me down. Here comes a jet plane. I can see the wheels hit the ground. However long I wait, I'm standing at the gate looking around.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support from Sisiv, building custom e-business systems for Global 2000 companies worldwide. On the web at CYSIVE.com. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at REEL.com. AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House and its Bell Tower Books Division, publisher of The Book of Jewish Values, A Day-to-Day Guide to Ethical Living by Rabbi Joseph Telushkin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
How do some schizophrenic people end up living on the street, carrying on inscrutable conversations with invisible people? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Nathaniel Lackenmeyer, whose father became one of the mentally ill homeless. Lackenmeyer has written a new book about him called The Outsider. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.